From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The ceasefire in Ukraine was still holding Tuesday. We have this report from Press TV's Lena Savchuk from Kiev.
The implementation of some of 12 points of the agreement reached in Minsk last Friday between pro-Russian fighters and the Ukrainian government is now underway. 1,200 Ukrainian captive soldiers have been released since the ceasefire was announced, and according to Ukrainian president, over 860 more will be exchanged till the end of the week. The truce has been held despite sporadic spates of violence, with each side accusing the other for the shelling.
Despite the ceasefire, the situation in the conflict zone remains challenging. Bombings of the Ukrainian positions continue. However, the nature of these attacks has changed. Positions are usually attacked with mortars and small arms and not with the heavy artillery.
However, it's unclear how long the lull in fighting will last. Many of the points of the protocol, such as special status of Donetsk and Lugansk and removal of illegal paramilitary groups and military hardware, are understood quite differently by both sides. Pro-Russians say they want more economic and political power than just decentralization proposed by Kiev. However, special status for eastern regions, which would be accepted by pro-Russians, is likely to provoke a public backlash against Ukrainian president in the rest of the country, as it would hamper Ukraine's further integration in the European Union. Pro-Russians also say that the government forces should withdraw from their territory, and Kiev considers all pro-Russian militia as paramilitary groups on its soil. However, some experts say that these provisions will not break the ceasefire.
The other points were put in the protocol because Petro Poroshenko insisted on that. He needs to justify himself before his allies who support war. At the same time, he needs to placate the public, which does not accept any truce with pro-Russian militia, which Ukrainian media describe only as terrorist.
Apart from the chasm and mistrust after months of fighting, there are other obstacles which make it difficult for the warring sides to achieve the accord.
The peace deal needs adopting unpopular laws, but this will be very difficult as Ukrainian parliament is now guided by political imperatives aimed at boosting their chances to win elections scheduled for 26th of October.
Observers say that Minsk protocol itself does not create conditions to resolve the Ukrainian crisis. However, any shaky truce is better than a full-out war. Lena Savchuk, Press TV, Kiev.
Meanwhile, the Dutch Safety Board Tuesday issued its preliminary report on the investigation into the crash of Malaysian Airlines flight MH17 over East Ukraine. The preliminary report presents only factual information from sources made available to the Safety Board thus far. This was the board's chair, Tibby Joustra.
The MH17 crash has shocked the world and raised many questions. The Dutch Safety Board wishes to determine the cause of the crash for the sake of the loved ones of the victims and for society at large. Aviation investigators from Australia, Malaysia, Ukraine, the Russian Federation, the United Kingdom, the United States and the Netherlands are working together to try to answer this question. They have various resources at their disposal, including the flight data recorder and the cockpit voice recorder. These sources indicate that flight MH17 proceeded as normal until it ended abruptly. Listening to the communications among the crew members in the cockpit via the cockpit voice recorder revealed no sign of any technical faults or an emergency situation. The pattern created by the wreckage on the ground suggests an in-flight breakup of the aircraft. The available images show that pieces of wreckage were punctured in numerous places. The pattern of damage to the body of the aircraft and the cockpit is consistent with the damage that would be expected from a large number of high-energy objects that penetrated the aircraft. This is probably what led to the structural damage to the aircraft and would also explain the abrupt end to the data registration on the recorders, the simultaneous loss of contact with air traffic control, and the aircraft's disappearance from the radar. The initial results of the investigations point towards an external cause of the MH17 crash. More research will be necessary to determine the cause with greater precision. The Safety Board believes that additional evidence will become available for the investigation in the period ahead. From this point on, the investigation team will be working towards producing its final report. The board aims to publish this report within 1 year of the date of the crash.
Ustra emphasized that the results published in the preliminary report are thus far indefinite and that experts have not been able to determine who downed the airplane. The Dutch investigators used information from the black box, air traffic control, satellite images, and photos from the scene of the crash to compile the preliminary report. Experts from the UK, Germany, Australia, Malaysia, the US, Ukraine, and Russia are part of the team of investigators collaborating in the final report. It's back to school for Palestinian children in Gaza, and the stories of 500,000 children in their What I Did Last Summer essays will be loaded with tales of death and destruction. Patrick Magua reports from the United Nations.
Over 500,000 Palestinian children will be returning to school on Sunday next week, but many will have no learning facilities as families displaced by last month's Israeli military action in Gaza are still camping in schools. This is according to the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF. Data by the Palestinian Minister of Education indicates that 25 government schools were completely destroyed and at least 207 others, including 75 run by the UN agency assisting Palestinians, UNRWA, suffered varying degrees of damage. UNICEF says many children will also be returning to school still traumatized by the violence, death and destruction they witnessed during the 50-day conflict. The agency says it will repair at least 108 partially damaged schools over the next 6 months, subject to availability of funding. Jens Lerck from the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs gives an update on the situation in Gaza.
There are still, as of yesterday, more than 63,000 internally displaced, staying in 29 UNRWA schools as a result of the 50 days of conflicts. The numbers are fluid. There are also an additional 50,000 other displaced who are living with host families. So in total, more than 113,000 still displaced. Humanitarian partners on the ground report that to respond to this displacement, funds are needed quite urgently to finance a comprehensive support package, which will include support to the host families, rental subsidies, assistance to minor damages and repairs, and things such as vouchers to purchase non-food items. We could also report that some 90% of health facilities in Gaza are now operational again, although some with limited services due to damage. However, challenges remain due to shortages of electricity, essential medicines, and other medical supplies.
At least 2,132 Palestinians, among them 501 children, were killed during the 50-day Israeli military offensive in Gaza that ended in a ceasefire on August 26th. Patrick Maigua, United Nations, Geneva.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov Tuesday warned the West not to bomb the ISIS Islamic State fighters in Syria without consulting the Syrian government, saying the alleged anti-ISIS attacks may end up as cover for U.S. forces to launch airstrikes against President Bashar al-Assad's forces. Lavrov said to reporters in Moscow, quote, "There are reasons to suspect that airstrikes on Syrian territory may target not only areas controlled by Islamic State militants, but government troops may also be attacked on the quiet to weaken the positions of Bashar al-Assad's army," closed quote. He warned that such a development would lead to a huge escalation of conflict in the Middle East and North Africa. Moscow is urging the West to respect international law and undertake such acts only with the approval of the legitimate government of the state. Lavrov added that no single country should be acting on its own. He called for only combined, collective, univocal actions. His comments came shortly after Washington announced plans to go on the offensive against the Islamic State. The U.S. military has already launched over 100 airstrikes against militant targets in Iraq, including a new series that the military said killed an unusually large number of Islamic State fighters. The battle between the U.S. and ISIS was the subject of this commentary from Behind the Wall by Mumia Abu-Jamal.
War by another name. With the rapid strikes and seizures of Iraqi territory by the Islamic State, commonly known as ISIS, the West, given a splendid pretext by the horrific decapitations of two journalists, is mounting a counterattack, if only by air. So far, no Western state has yet announced the deployment of ground troops. Why are they there? They claim that ISIS is a threat to their homelands, surely a stretch by any honest measure. For ISIS has, according to most accounts, 20,000 troops, at best, according to some sources, 10,000. According to the International Institute for Strategic Studies, Iraq has 247,000 active troops, well over 20 times ISIS's troop strength. ISIS has no air force, nor navy, nor tanks, except those left behind in Iraqi bases by their fleeing troops. How then is ISIS an imminent threat to the U.S., not to mention the West? They have an aggressive and able armed force. But how could they roust Iraqi troops so easily, unless Iraqis had little to fight for in the first place? Truth is, it's hard to fight for a puppet. And although former Prime Minister Nouri Kamel al-Maliki is no longer in power, a U.S. puppet still runs Iraq. The real reason U.S. troops withdrew from Iraq had nothing to do with the Iraqi people. It withdrew because al-Maliki refused to sign a so-called Status of Force Agreement, a pact granting U.S. troops total immunity for any action committed on Iraqi lands. Any action? The idea is breathtaking. Even a puppet couldn't bear it. And now, to protect their puppet state, the U.S. bombs Iraqi targets described as ISIS hotspots. But bombs are weapons of war, not tools of peace. Call it what you will, it's still war. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Representatives of the Union of South American Nations, UNASUR, and the African Union met Monday in Ecuador to discuss concrete measures for future cooperation. The Ecuadorian Foreign Minister, Ricardo Patiño, called for a strengthening of relations between the two regional groups. During a meeting of an ad hoc committee of the South America-Africa Cooperation Forum in preparation for the summit in 2016, the Ecuadorian official recalled that the relationship had been mediated by the U.S. and Europe, the former colonizing powers, before the creation of the new group in 2006. Patiño, speaking in the office of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs with representatives of the AU and UNASUR present, said, quote, "The key to our development is here, in the South, closer than we imagined," closed quote, adding that the forum should completely end their dependence on the developed countries. Coming on the heels of the tragic events in Ferguson, Missouri, a new report examines how racial perceptions of crime are a key cause of the severe racial disparity in sentencing in the criminal justice system in the U.S. The report, Race and Punishment, Racial Perceptions of Crime and Support for Punitive Policies, was authored by Dr. Nazgo Ghanouche, research analyst at the Sentencing Project. It synthesizes two decades of research which reveal a sobering fact. White Americans support punitive policies that disproportionately impact people of color because they hold strong associations of crime with blacks and Latinos. Dr. Ghanouche spoke with Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford about the findings.
I put this report together really thinking a lot about what happened after Oscar Grant's death, after Trayvon Martin's death, and so those incidents were really fresh in my mind. And just in the final moments of preparing it before its release, we had the shooting of Michael Brown, and again that illustrated all of these questions about what's going on? Why is it that we see these incidents where police officers and regular civilians who are armed are, you know, in these very suspicious situations shooting unarmed African Americans? And so this report, I think, sheds some light on that, but it also tries to show that it's actually a much bigger issue at play here. So what's happening is, in, you know, we're not sure yet what happened with Michael Brown's death, but we know that there are really important questions that need to be asked and answered. And we also know that without the complete picture, white Americans and people of color tend to kind of go in very different directions as far as what their expectations are in these circumstances. And even when the issue is resolved, so for example, when we had the verdict with George Zimmerman, when you had the verdict on Rodney King going back that far, people have very different reactions in terms of whether they think that justice was served or not. So part of that has to do with perceptions of the criminal justice system and how fair and just it is. And another part of it has to do with perceptions of who commits crime in this country and how much criminality we associate with people of color versus with whites. And I'm happy to talk a little bit more about that.
Well, what kind of methodology did you bring to bear in addressing these questions?
I really tried to provide as comprehensive an account as possible on research that's been conducted by academic organizations, by nonprofit organizations, by government agencies that looked at several different areas related to this question of, do whites tend to overestimate how much crime is committed by people of color, or just do they tend to associate people of color with criminality, and what are the consequences of that? So some of this research asks white Americans very directly, so how much crime, how much robbery, how much burglary do you think is committed by whites versus by African Americans? And when researchers did this, they found that whites had an exaggerated assessment of how much these crimes were committed by African Americans. What they did there was they compared what they learned in their surveys to actual arrest data, and they found that there was about a 20 to 30% overestimation for a lot of violent crimes and juvenile crimes, when whites, overestimation in the sense of whites attributed a higher proportion to African Americans than was actually the case based on arrest data. There's also psychological research that's been done through controlled laboratory experiments where, and this is implicit bias research, that asks people, shows them images, for example, a black face and a white face, shows them a kind of blurry image of something that is either a weapon or it's a tool. And people are asked to quickly identify what they're looking at. And what these studies do is they look at when a person is shown a white face versus a black face, does that distort their impression of what they're seeing? And they find that it does actually quite a bit, that whites tend to mistakenly identify something that's not a gun as a gun when they're first shown a black face versus a white face. They also take longer to correctly identify tools as tools, for example, when they're shown a black face. So these studies measure both accuracy and speed, and they're able to show that there's this implicit bias in a lot of the reasoning that people are using in order to go through these experiments. And then a third area of research is just looking at what the actual work of both criminal justice organizations and lawmakers, what policies do we have, what kinds of decisions are prosecutors making and judges. When you control for differences between whites and non-whites, differences even including class, differences including the severity of their offense, criminal history, there's been research that shows that whites get a better deal when they go through the criminal justice system for the exact same crime as what people of color have committed. So that's another area of research that I looked at, in addition to media. How does the media portray criminal defendants and suspects, and what kind of racial disparities are there in that setting?
I guess there is a real difference here, certainly in social impact, between a white sales clerk who looks at a black person in the store and sees someone casing the joint, and looks at a white person in the store and sees a customer. There's a difference between that and a policeman or a prosecutor who's not supposed to be imagining crimes. They're supposed to be gathering evidence of actual crimes.
Exactly. And the conclusions that I was able to draw in this report, based on the survey of research, is that a lot of times this kind of bias, so many people have it. A majority of whites have it. A substantial portion of even African Americans and people of color have this kind of bias as well. So famously, you know, years ago, Reverend Jesse Jackson talked about, and there have been many other examples of this, of when seeing an African American young man walking down the street, of being a little bit more nervous than if the person was white. So it's not just whites, but importantly, it's also not just whites that are sort of traditional, just racist. These are people who subscribe to ideas of racial equality and tolerance, but these ideas are so ingrained in our culture that we can't help it. I mean, I can even think of examples of myself doing this. There's a car rental company behind my house, and routinely I see whites going up to this car that's there. It's a sort of a car that they use a card to access and rent. I see whites using that system, and I think, oh, those people are going to rent a car. When I see, you know, one time I caught myself that there was a young couple, African-American couple, and I looked and I thought, well, why are they back there? And I realized they're back there doing the same thing that everybody else does there that I never think twice about. And, you know, the racial difference made it so that suddenly I became more suspicious, right? So I wrote this report. I'm someone who's really conscious about these things. I really want to try to weed racial inequality out of the criminal justice system and all parts of society. But my goal here is not to say, to just cast blame to some fringe segment of our population, but to suggest that we all have this. We all use these kind of heuristics in our thinking, and unless we admit to them and consciously monitor their consequences, then they're just going to go unchecked.
These kinds of subjective perceptions are not limited to whites, but they are rooted in a culture of white supremacy.
That's right. That's right. And so they come from our media representations of crime and justice are just saturated with images of this report. You know, there have been a lot of studies that look at, in specific jurisdictions, like in Los Angeles or other cities, what proportion of the suspects that are shown or written about are white or black or Latino relative to the proportion that are reported as committing crimes in arrest records. And a lot of times there are racial disparities. There's an emphasis on people of color. There's also another kind of bias that researchers have shown, in that a disproportionate amount of the crimes that are shown are ones where the suspect is a person of color and the victim is white. And so this creates this impression that the whites are really likely to fall prey to crimes committed by people of color, and that's not the case. Most crime is intraracial, so it's black against black or white against white. But yet there's this distortion that happens that when we translate what's actually happening in the world to what we're seeing in the media, and that has a big impact. And so this impact is something that's really important. The impact is not just that criminal justice professionals disproportionately target people of color or give them a worse deal as they go through the criminal justice system. This is true. This is part of it. But another consequence of it is that the research that I highlight in this report, and that's really sort of the center of this report, is that the more whites associate crime with people of color, the more supportive they are of punitive policies in general for everybody. So this doesn't even just impact people of color going through the criminal justice system. And this affects even whites going through the justice system, because as a consequence of these subjective perceptions, we have greater support among whites for the death penalty. We have greater support among whites for mandatory minimum sentences, for three strikes laws, all kinds of punitive policies that don't just affect people of color. They disproportionately affect people of color, but they actually contribute overall to the excessive punishment that we have in this country for everybody.
That is white supremacist culture being translated into law.
That's right. What we see is that these kinds of racial associations of crime, they affect our entire society, and they affect all parts of our criminal justice system. So they affect public sentiment, and we know that judges and prosecutors are responsive to what the public wants in terms of the degree of harshness in sentencing. It then goes on to affect the work of criminal justice practitioners and lawmakers, and so we have famously the incident where George Bush Sr., you know, during his campaign against Dukakis, really highlighted the case of Willie Horton, who was an African-American man that committed terrible crimes against white victims and really helped with his election. And there have been many other instances where policymakers are using crime and politicizing crime and race in a sort of implicit, subtle way in order to further their campaigns and developing policies around these ideas. And then they also affect the work, as I mentioned earlier, of criminal justice practitioners, prosecutors, judges, but even public defenders. So there's research showing that in the way that the limited time that public defenders have and what they decide to, how they triage racial biases affect how they do their work. So if they tend to think that black defendants are more likely to be guilty, they'll dedicate a little bit less time to those cases than to white defendants that they have more empathy for. And so again, what's really interesting here is this is a population within the criminal justice system that is there to help people and that often has a, you know, racial analysis and wants to help people of color and recognizes the disparate impact that African Americans and Latinos are experiencing. But these things are just unconscious, subtle, and, you know, unless we really monitor them and acknowledge them, they affect all of our work. There's also been research that shows that jurors, they've done this with mock juries where they've been able to show that there's some impact on the decisions of juries based on the race of the defendant. There's not nearly enough to address, but there have been some efforts. So in North Carolina, there was a law that was passed in order to make sure that there was greater diversity in the jury pool, because this is something that helps a lot. So making sure that there are people of color in the jury pool does a lot to make jurors more conscious about race and potential bias, and this helps a lot to deliver more fair outcomes, and it prolongs the time that jurors deliberate. That's one effect that's been found, and it makes it less likely, for example, in death penalty cases, that a jury will decide to impose the death penalty on a defendant. Unfortunately, that law was overturned in North Carolina, but, you know, around the country, there are some judges that are trying to implement similar kinds of practices to make jurors aware of these issues. And what's promising is that we know in many cases, once people are made aware of their biased behavior, and once they realize that their behavior actually contradicts the principles that they subscribe to and are hoping to advance, it motivates them to change their behavior. And so there's definitely room for optimism. But the first important step is to recognize and admit that we're not colorblind in our decision making, contrary to what we might hope. Even those of us who really are actively trying to pursue racial justice, when you actually look at our work, a lot of times, either, you know, especially among criminal justice professionals, either just because of individual discretion or organizational policy, we're not treating people fairly, regardless of their race.
Your study and others like it would seem to bolster those who say that the black mass incarceration regime that we've had with us for at least 40 years is the product not of increases of crime or based in realities, but a punitive response on the part of white people who imagine that black folks present such a great danger to their safety.
That's exactly right. One thing I would clarify about that. So first, there's been research that's shown that, for example, since 1980, from 1980 till 2010 was when a really big bulk of the growth in the prison population has happened. And every year in that period, the prison population grew. But crime rates went up and down during that time. So it's not the case that a crime spike during that entire time from 1980 to 2010 would account for why we have such a large prison population. So instead, what accounts for it is more people were being sent to prison, and they were being sent there for a long longer periods of time. And so with the first example, clearly with drug crimes illustrate this, that drug offenses and drug laws illustrate this best, and that we didn't have, you know, in the 1950s and 60s, we weren't sending a lot of people to prison because of drug use and drug sales, whereas we started to do this with the war on drugs. And the war on drugs, even though we know from research, for example, conducted by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, that whites, African Americans, Latinos use drugs at similar rates. For some categories, whites even use drugs at greater rates. We even know, in addition to that, that people generally buy drugs from somebody of the same race and ethnicity as them. So if drug laws were being fairly enforced, then the population in the prison system for drug law violations would represent the general population. That would mean they would be mostly white.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.